This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers. And swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
First thing you want to know about hippogriffs is that they're very proud creatures. Very easily offended. You do not want to insult a hippogriff. It may just be the last thing you ever do. Now, who'd like to come and say hello?
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today we're going through part two of two episodes of Some of the Creatures of Harry Potter. As always, this show is broken up into a couple of different segments. We'll have time codes below so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. Unless you're listening to us on Spotify, in which case, sorry. Anyway, my name is still Sam Parent, freshwater ecologist at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. I run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside co-host number one, Adam Harsick, who is a disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas. We're your movie ecologists. And as always, we're joined by co-host number two, Dave, who is a vet and our movie physiologist. Today, we are looking at the ecology of the basilisk and the phoenix. We had a look at their physiology last week, as well as a bit of a look at the dementors. Dave had some really cool mechanisms, and we talked about some truly horrible members of the animal kingdom. So I highly recommend going back and having a listen to that.
Either you ever seen anything like that? You ever heard of anything like that? Huh? Me neither. And I watch Animal Planet all the fucking time.
Okay, so this week, since we can't really do the history of Harry Potter films, because, I mean, it's not a long-running history, and if you've listened to this podcast and you appreciate it, you've probably seen these films already. What we thought we'd do is we talk about, since, you know, the basilisk is tied to Salazar Slytherin, and apparently the phoenix is tied to Gryffindors, we thought I'd just run over some of the more iconic examples of animal familiars in movies, and to a certain extent in TV series, because there's one recent TV series that I guess we should start with, The Golden Compass, or the Northern Lights Trilogy, as I think it's called, which has a really kind of unique take on animal familiars. So have you guys read these books?
No, I have not.
No.
I've read one of the recent prequels. My partner loves these books, and we kind of enjoyed the first series on TV.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. In this universe, humans are born with an animal kind of partner that they grow up with during their life. That partner can change shape up until puberty, at which point that animal becomes a fixed species, which kind of reflects the human's personality. I have so many questions about this that we can potentially get into in a different episode, but it's a really interesting take on the concept of familiars. I cannot remember for the life of me what they're called in the show, though.
Polar bears.
Yeah, polar bears. Yes. Everyone's just roaming around with a polar bear. Demons. That's what they're called. Demons. Yeah. Now, you can kind of just chuck a lot of the Disney characters under this. And I'm not just talking about, you know, a pretty woman who sings along with the birdies and that sort of thing. I mean, you've got Aladdin and Abu, Jafar and Iago. You've got Ariel and her mates. Okay, so hang on. Ariel is a bit of a different one because those are two very anthropomorphic.
You could just say Ariel and Sebastian and Flounder.
Yeah, but is, like, would you consider that, like, are they a pet anymore? Are they, like, a companion animal? Or are they just, like, a friend? Because...
Oh, Sebastian is a slave. Sebastian would not be there if he didn't have to be. If the king wasn't continuously threatening to boil him alive, Sebastian would be on a beach somewhere reconnecting with his disjointed family.
Yeah.
Yeah, very possibly. I really like... Look, I know that Shrek is an ogre, but I think Shrek and Donkey is a fantastic example of, like, a... again, I guess they're more friends, but it really does seem like the human-familiar relationship a lot of the time.
Another a recent example, kind of a little bit outside of film, but a kind of a fun one that I thought to bring up because of its uniqueness, is the character Flack in the video game Borderlands 3. Flack is a robot that you can play as, and specifically they, because they are, my partner and I were looking this up, I believe the very first non-binary playable character in a video game. And they have either a skag, which is like a wolf dog thing, a spider ant, which is a gigantic arthropod monster, or a jabber, which is like a monkey, a small little primate. And those can be your companions, depending on what kind of skill tree you want to progress through, and it's pretty cool.
And just as a quick note of how popular it is to see a human paired with an animal companion, that Beastmaster character in the Borderlands 3 game is the most popular character that players play as.
It's the one I play as. It's so much fun.
Really?
People like having pets, man. I wouldn't have a job if that wasn't the case.
And Flack, they always talk to it. It's like, good job, beast. It's really fun. And you can, one option in the game is you can pet your beast.
My partner and I were watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Nope.
Not yet, no.
Anyways, I recommend watching it. They have a very good dog that's in the entire film, who I would say is the character that's, I found myself most emotionally invested in.
In the game that came out about a year and a half ago, Red Dead Redemption 2, there's an option they revealed in the trailer where you can like walk up to a dog and pet the dog. And it's like, you know, press X to pet. And the character's like, who's a good dog? And everyone's like, we have reached the pinnacle of video games.
That was one of my favorite memes from GIFs or TikToks or Vines, whatever they were called back then, was this shot of somebody petting a dog in the video game and then moving the camera over to their actual real life dog who was just sitting there like, what the fuck is this? Sabrina and her cat.
Salem.
Is, you know, kind of the classic Witcher's familiar.
Yeah, Witcher and Roach. I recently, to what would make Adam very happy, have started replaying the third Witcher game.
Hell yeah.
And I fucking love Roach.
Roach is the best.
I was going to kind of exclude dogs from this list, but there's a couple that I really wanted to mention. One is Tintin. Not traditionally a movie character, but I really like the Tintin movie.
Yeah.
Fucking whatever it's called. Curse of the Bucket Ship or... Look, I don't know the name, but I love the film. I love his dog.
Snowy.
I think it's fantastic. And the second dog, or dogs I should say, that I wanted to mention as classic familiars were Ramsay Bolton and his pack of hounds. I was going to use Daenerys Targaryen as the only Game of Thrones one.
Not the Starks and their direwolves, but Ramsay Bolton and his pack of murderous hounds.
Yeah, I think the story has a much more satisfying conclusion with Ramsay Bolton and his hounds.
I agree.
I think you get a lot more closure with that relationship.
Yeah.
And one of the early classics that kind of from Disney, because I neglected to mention this earlier, is Merlin and Archimedes, which I remember really, really loving as a kid.
Pocahontas and Flit the Hummingbird and What's-His-Face the Raccoon. And then the Pugsley, the pug, and the Baron.
People like their animals. We're weird. I'd never thought about that before, but you're right. We not only like to pair ourselves with other creatures, as Adam is demonstrating with his cat in the background right now.
Yeah,
God, he was hungry.
But we like to see characters paired with animals, and characters will get infinitely better when you pair them with a... Like the Queen of Dragons, her most defining trait is the dragons.
And I'll give a dishonorable mention to Frank. The pug from the Men in Black films was a bit of fun the first time round, and there was just too much of the second time round.
Yeah, little bit is fine, too much is not good.
But yeah, look, we've probably missed a few, but I think we should get into the rest of the Harry Potter episode.
Wow, get your paws off!
Call the pound, we got a stray!
The dog owes my friend money.
Stop it, okay.
All right, so before we get into the ecology, if you've got any thoughts or questions on this or any other podcast, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at SamperinNTNU. Adam is at ArsicAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit cinematicaanimalia.com or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I are doing, or just, you know, get your weekly ecology news update, go to ecologyforthemasses.com. We have new articles on Monday and Thursdays, and we do a paper of the week every Wednesday. Right, so before we kind of get into the ecology of specific creatures, we kind of want to talk about the magical world in general and the evolutionary history of animals within the magical world, because you have all these species that should have shown up in the fossil record in some way or another that humans should kind of know about. I know, you know, there's probably all sorts of traps like wizards come and wipe them out, wipe their memories. But, you know, humans should be aware of the existence of some of these creatures, particularly because a lot of them are very large. And so the theory we kind of had was that magic has caused much faster mutations, leading to much faster evolution in these magical creatures. And alongside what we think is probably widespread domestication of some of these animals, because if you've got magic, it makes it a hell of a lot easier to domesticate a lot more animals that would have previously been too fast or small to get your hands on, too difficult to catch, too powerful to have around. And so if you have, you know, prolonged exposure to magic, which could in this case, you know, act as kind of radiation, that could cause, you know, much faster mutations. Plus, if you're breeding for certain traits, be it, you know, to have them work as pack animals like the thestrals.
Yeah.
For ornamental animals like the phoenix, I guess. Or, you know, animals that are bred for certain tasks. Like, I'm pretty sure some of the things that they fight in their third year when Lupin's putting them through their paces, I'm pretty sure they're just examples of animals that they tried to breed for certain tasks, like the boggart and that sort of stuff, that just got out of hand. They couldn't control them, so they ran rampant because I'm sure there was a lot of poor experimentation with when people started magically domesticating animals, which is probably why the Americans are so fucking hard on it in the Fantastic Beasts films. That's what I like to think anyway.
I mean, I think it's also just a wise precaution about that. Like, it's the same thing with like Australia and New Zealand with their very, very hard like immigration rules for any kind of wildlife because it's a vulnerable ecosystem. Maybe for whatever reason, magic originated in Europe and you bring in these invasive magical creatures to North America and it's like, whoa. Calm down.
Ruined everything, yeah. And there's a lot of examples of things that wouldn't be possible even outside of, you know, the magical abilities of some of these things. Like, for instance, you've got that enormous lion that kind of looks exactly like a Chinese dragon that can, like, fly from place to place. Even outside of there, you've got some features purely just based on the physiology that we see that seem ridiculous. Like, for instance, that enormous kind of rhino-hippo cross creature that's much, much larger in the first Fantastic Beasts film that Eddie Redmayne does that insanely weird mating dance with.
Beautifully seductive dance.
It's incredible. That man won an Oscar, I think, 2 years beforehand for The Theory of Everything. And then he was sucked into Fantastic Beasts and Jupiter Ascending. Oh, look, he had a couple of real ups and downs. Anyway, that thing is enormous. It is far too big. We've talked about, when we've spoken about Godzilla, when we've spoken about the dragons, we've talked about the fact that if you are a really large animal, it's almost a necessity that you have an enormous geographic range. The largest land mammal we've ever had is the Paracetherium. And that thing, I cannot remember for the life of me what it was called, the thing that Eddie Redmayne tries to fuck, but that was noticeably larger than the Paracetherium. So, I mean, size is selected for. Its geographic range would have to be enormous unless it has some sort of magical mutation which allows it to get a lot more energy out of a much smaller food source.
If we're living in a world where magic exists, I think we have to go with the conceit that, like, Hogwarts defense is basically it's an anti-memory field. Basically, whenever somebody got close to it that's not magical, they'd be like, oh, there's something else they need to be doing, or they'd forget why they were there, and they would just kind of turn around and leave. And there's also illusions over it, so they can't physically see it either.
So you think potentially some of this is rubbed off on some of those magical creatures? Or do you think the wizards have, you know, they've grown, they've started enacting conservation measures, they've started creating these, you know, large protected areas whereby some of these creatures can exist?
I think it would have to be something like that. Like, it has to be some kind of protective area. I don't see illusion being part of these creatures, because humans themselves, I don't think, are going to pose so much of a threat to them as a species.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're still going to be affected in the same way that a lot of other species are, by fragmentation, pollution, climate change, perhaps not, you know, direct land use or, you know, hunting or over exploitation of the creatures. But I think other stuff is still going to affect them quite badly, especially the larger ones. So that Kelpie that we see in the second Fantastic Beasts movie. The basilisk, for sure, because that is a big, big creature. Huge snake. A lot of these species are going to suffer from the same thing that we've always talked about when we've talked about large creatures, which is they're going to have really low population sizes because the protected areas that wizards are going to be able to put up are probably going to be quite small. Unless, you know, they're enacting large-scale situations that Newt Scamander has in his suitcase where, you know, you can make areas much larger. In which case, perhaps they could provide a geographic range large enough for a lot of these creatures to persist in. It feels weird talking about, like, our solution for inbreeding, because the creatures can't be magical. But the solution is these, you know, magical pockets that, you know. A lot of these creatures are really fucking big. And humans as well. I mean, the giants have grown enormous. And I think they're probably a product of, you know, prolonged exposure to radiation.
They're huge, and they like, alter the landscape.
But, I think that a lot of the humanoid species in this, so you've got the goblins, the giants, the dementors potentially as well, you know, products of the same sort of situation you see in Aquaman, where you have the one humanoid species. In this case, I think it's just Homo sapiens. and prolonged exposure to these levels of radiation or magic have created these, you know, kind of evolutionary branches that would never have been able to happen if you didn't have a enforced selection for them by humans and B, faster rates of mutation caused by the radiation, which is in this case magic.
Cool.
That's it. We have to fight fire with fire. If nuclear refuse gave them superpowers, it could do the same for me. Citizens, I'm off to the toxic waste dump.
Mayor West, you have lymphoma.
Oh, my.
Probably from rolling around in that toxic waste.
A lot of these species seem to have kind of analogs in the real world. So we've already talked about the rhino, the four-winged griffin thing. What was it called again, Adam?
Thunderbird. It's meant to represent the Thunderbird in some way.
Yeah. But I mean, it just looks like a real big fucking eagle with, you know, obviously with two sets of wings, which, weird. I don't know why two sets of wings pisses me off so much if it's not on an insect, but all these strange things. And it's like, no, two sets of wings can't, no, I'm not having it. And yeah, so there's a lot of real world analogs. So there are, you know, evolutionary pathways that are present. So let's start with the phoenix. That was kind of easy to come up with because it does look very much like a bird of prey that's just gotten a little more flamboyant. Watched a couple of shows of RuPaul's Drag Race and thought, I'm there.
It's kind of like a peacock and a raptor put together.
Yeah, like a real big fucking buzzard. Because, I mean, the only problem I really have with its body plan is the tail's way too long.
It's like a bird of paradise.
Yeah, you don't really see that in the raptor world.
Yeah, and the birds that do have that longer tail don't tend to have extended flight plans.
Nor are they mobile. They can't agilely move through the air.
So it wouldn't fit with a predatory creature that was flying long distances.
No, it doesn't really make sense. But, I mean, if you're at home, just kind of look it up. Adam and I found a couple of different species. The Egyptian vulture, buzzards, lamergeiers. They kind of look like the phoenix, except, you know, the phoenix has much more distinct kind of plumage. They don't have the exposed neck as well, which a lot of vultures and carrion eaters do. So I don't know what Dumbledore is feeding that creature, but it's probably either carcasses or live prey. I would probably say scavenger.
Some kind of enhanced diet.
Oh, God, that would get really dark if it turned out that he just had the basilisk in the basement because he was feeding the babies to Fox all the time.
I mean, it makes sense as far as your mechanism last week, Dave, of having this creature having these advanced healing factors in its mouth, its oral tract, its GI, to deal with this incredibly venomous creature. But if we extend that to it eating something that's decomposing and full of bacteria and venom, this works even better. And it looks like a vulture.
We should talk about the fact that, falconers, people who have made pets of birds of prey for a long time. Generally, they're smaller ones, hawks, falcons, buzzards, that sort of thing. Never as large as like a vulture or a larger eagle. But I mean, again, what we were talking about before is that if you have magic, you have the ability to kind of harness and domesticate much larger creatures. So I think that's potentially what's happened here. They're wild animals. They potentially don't even have those long tail feathers and that really stark coloring as a product of their natural populations. It might just be humans have bred for it.
And it could just be a very limited thing as well, because Dumbledore himself, I'm guessing, is incredibly wealthy. He's a bit kooky, and it would make sense that he has this very rare and hard to acquire exotic pet, which is basically what a phoenix is.
He's basically the magical equivalent of that guy from Tiger King.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Joe Exotic?
Yeah, Joe Exotic, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that it's just a matter of time until J.K. Rowling comes out and says that Dumbledore actually had a meth addiction.
Oh, my God, yeah. Now, we've got to talk about the Rising from the Ashes stuff when we talk about phoenixes. Now, I've been reading a bit of Terry Pratchett lately. He has some really good explanations for some magical creatures in there. And I want to read, like, this next bit out. Maybe the phoenix, whatever it really looked like, was simply a bird who'd worked out a way of making incubation work very, very fast. And this, to me, makes a lot more sense than the bird dying and being reborn again and rising from its own ashes. Because, I mean, a lot of people would perhaps think of the immortal jellyfish. So the immortal jellyfish, it's a bit of a misnomer because it's not really the same organism. So what happens is when this jellyfish gets to a certain age, it will kind of revert back to its original form and grow again. But it's not really doing that. It's using its body to create kind of like a clone of itself that goes back to an initial state. So it's not really the same organism. it genetically it's the same organism, but it's kind of not the same thing.
Okay.
The closest thing you could probably get to it is the Doctor, but again, I mean, we don't know anything about jellyfish, you know, memory retention.
Still not the same.
No, still not the same, yeah. There's a Finnish woman who works at the museum who gave this really good talk on death recently. Typical Finnish custom, you meet people, you tell them all about death, that sort of thing.
I say Finn, makes sense.
She wrote a book which has a Finnish title. It hasn't been translated yet. She's hoping to get it translated in the future. But she went and talked about it. And I was kind of distraught because until that point, I had thought that, yeah, the immortal jellyfish was kind of doing what the Doctor does in Doctor Who. But no, unfortunately, it's kind of just, you know, using its body to create a clone of itself. And I think that a phoenix isn't even doing this. I think a phoenix just has a really, really short incubation period. I also think that it's constantly eating. It's bringing back food for the chick to eat once it comes out. But it also needs a really hot temperature to incubate as fast as it does. I'm not an ornithologist. I've looked at a couple of papers on this sort of stuff just to look at viviparity in birds, which is not a thing at all. It's a thing in some reptiles, though. So there is one species of reptile that's native to Norway, which is just called the viviparous lizard. Gives birth to live young.
Some snakes do as well.
Yeah, some snakes. So squamates. So it's the largest order of reptiles. They've got lizards, snakes, and some worm lizards in there as well. And they're the ones who are most likely to be viviparous.
Yeah, you were saying some reptiles do it, and birds are reptiles. Look it up. But I think what could make this work, because a really, really fast incubation time doesn't work physiologically. You can't go from a cluster of cells to a fully formed organism in a matter of hours. But I think if these are magical, weird creatures, maybe this is some weird oviparity, viviparity hybrid where these individuals develop inside of the mother, inside of an egg.
Yeah.
And then they lay the eggs when they're really, really close to their hatching date. So it seems like they lay them and they hatch like immediately. So it's like, oh, these phoenixes are just being reincarnated or whatever.
Yes.
But maybe they're born somewhat capable, like a lot of insects and fish are. So the mother just fucks off as soon as she lays them. So it seems like it's the same bird reincarnated.
Yeah. And I think it's potentially like the ashes. It's just the concept of them having to keep the nest ready at a very high temperature. So there are some birds, for instance, mallee fowls and a lot of megapodes in Australia. So they use rotting, because rotting vegetation creates heat. They'll construct these enormous mounds that are like a meter and a half, 2 meters high. And they'll lay eggs in there. And within the center of the mound, they'll be able to keep that that center as like at a temperature range of like 0.2 degrees. It's incredible. So, but yeah, the ashes are maybe potentially just these raptors putting together these nests that are capable of incubating organisms at a really high temperature. Now, I don't know how the chicks would tolerate that temperature, but we're just going to have to put that down to a magical mutation, I think.
Okay.
So, yeah, like Adam said, just they develop for a really long time inside the mothers. They come out and then they hatch after, I don't know, a couple of hours, couple of days. Really, really quick incubation times, yeah. Now, this sort of stuff in reptiles, at least, it mainly evolves in kind of cold northern climates, generally at higher altitudes, which kind of fits our bird of prey theory. There's some debate as to whether, you know, people are confusing correlation for causation here.
Right.
Some people have said that it might be a product of viviparity, not the cause of viviparity. The fact that these species are often found in those areas, because, I mean, the species that are in those areas, they generally need to be better dispersers. If you're viviparous, you don't have to stick around with an egg quite as much. You can be a better disperser.
Gotcha.
So potentially, if these birds have taken a step, not complete viviparity, but a step towards viviparity, they're able to, you know, kind of turn up in these areas purely because they're better dispersers. They're better at moving around and can have larger ranges.
I think also touching on a bit of the phoenix's healing properties, kind of what Dave touched on last week. It's probably some kind of arms race dynamic where you have these individuals, these phoenixes evolving to be better and better and better at healing some kind of wound that would come from an organism that is getting more and more and more venomous over time. And you see this in North America, especially with newts and garter snakes, where these newts and salamanders have incredibly toxic chemicals in their mucus on their body, which can kill humans. And these organisms are incredibly toxic, but garter snakes can resist it. And because they can resist it, they evolve to become more toxic, and the garter snakes evolve to be more resistant to it.
Yeah.
So the phoenix is resistant to something that is getting more and more venomous over time.
Okay. Oh. That was really
real cobras?
Some are real, some are just robots filled with venom.
Now that is a true friend.
Last thing we should touch on is obviously the basilisk. Now, for Adam and I, like, because we really struggled to kind of find an evolutionary lineage here. Because you would think it's a snake just because of the way it's talked about and all that sort of stuff. But the head does not look anything like a snake's head. It may have the kind of the fangs at the front.
It's like a dragon.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, and then behind the fangs, you've got all these teeth. It does. It looks more like either a shorter-faced crocodile or gharial, maybe.
Yeah, like some kind of crocodilian, minus the legs.
Yeah, I was thinking because a lot of the facial structure looks a bit more like an iguana or a water dragon. But then you've got these enormous kind of fangs and teeth that are more crocodilian. And then, of course, like Dave was saying last week, we think this kind of evolved from some sort of organism that spits out or emits venom in some way, which is how you got to the point where it's not that it's going to kill you with a look. It's that it's spraying venom towards your face. So people are just, you know, so afraid of looking at it. But, I mean, do you know, apart from, you know, spitting cobras and that sort of stuff, how many things have you heard of that shoot venom at your face that's not a snake?
Super rare.
Yeah.
Super rare. And like even like the Jurassic Park, like the classic, like spitting is not real.
Yeah.
It's not a real species. The one that gets Newman.
Yes. But look, I mean, again, we it's maybe a bit of a cop-out for us this week. It's just, you know, we put it down to a magical mutation. Again, the size is a real issue here. And like we said last week, apparently these things have crazy metabolism because they can survive for up to 50 years without food.
Right, which certain snake species can go months without eating, and they've got really cool mechanisms where they actually pull blood supply out of their GI tract. So they basically like mummify their internal organs.
Cool.
But life requires input. It requires energy. Yeah. You can't go 50 years like...
So I have a theory for this as well. I think that what's happened is you will have this in a lot of like in lakes in certain areas up in the Arctic here. So Western Norway and Iceland are two really good examples of this, where you might up north only have one or two species of fish. And sometimes the Arctic char, for instance, are a great example. Some of those individuals within a population will start to become cannibals and grow really, really fucking big. Whereas you have others that just prey on insects and become mm-hmm. the predators within that same species. So what I think's happened is in that cave down there, you've got one big motherfucker that's just grown enormous and is cannibalizing smaller populations.
Aww.
So I think down in that chamber, you have a bunch of other basilisks, which are much smaller, like normal kind of snake size, that this thing's just been feeding on. You had maybe two or three of those big ones. It's now eaten all the other ones that are larger. It's just down to that one big cannibal basilisk being left. And you've got a lot of smaller morphs roaming around in the tunnels down there.
See, I really like this. And I think this also fits in that that Matthew McConaughey documentary, Reign of Fire, where the big dragon was eating all the small ones.
Yes. Yeah, fits in very well. I kind of wish we hadn't wasted Game of Thrones on dragons, because I think there's a lot more interesting stuff to talk about in Reign of Fire.
Yeah, but nobody's seen Reign of Fire. People have seen
it. It's so good.
That's so bad.
You've got Jerry Butler. What more do you need?
It was Jerry Butler in it?
Yeah, he's his best friend. His brother.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I think his best movie is still How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah.
I was devastated when he died in the second one. Spoiler alert, by the way.
It's really good when you say spoiler alert after you do it.
Yep.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. Bit late, but we got there in the end. Do we have anything more to go over with the basilisk this week? I think that's all we wanted to talk about, right?
I mean, kind of just going a bit further into what you were saying about, like, this folktale of it killing you with a look, it coming as a product from cultural history back at a time where wizards or humans, normal, non-magical humans, I refuse to use that stupid word, were living amongst these creatures, and this creature was so dangerous, either because it was fast or also just super venomous, they were just telling people that even being around it or seeing it would kill you.
Yeah.
Which goes hand in hand with the original myth of the basilisk being a creature that is so venomous that it hurts to look at it. Like, if you stab it with a spear, the poison races up your spear and kills you.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, again, as with a lot of these worlds, the zoologists in the Harry Potter world don't seem to be of much repute.
Yeah. That's fair.
Hagrid, look, that man is your classic example of a man who has got a lot of these pets. A real Joe Exotic type.
Ugh, God, we keep coming back to that.
Hagrid and Dumbledore are the two Joe Exotics of the Harry Potter
books. He's the best part of those books.
He is. I do like Hagrid.
Hagrid cares about the creatures at least. Dumbledore does not.
One thing I should say is there were obviously no more large basilisks left in that chamber, which is potentially why it was starting to venture out in the castle to get more food. But that directly conflicts with the fact that it doesn't eat any of its prey. It paralyzes, what, 4 or 5 people over the course of the second book? Doesn't eat any of them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I want to see any of these. Colin Creevy.
That goes hand in hand with the domestication theory. Because if it's domesticated, it's going to be used to listening to humans' orders, even if it's a ghost human.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough, yeah. I don't think in this case it is domesticated. I think that basilisk is just wild down there in, like, the sewers.
Makes sense.
I think the whole talk to snakes thing is just some bullshit they made up. They just, like, sealed that off. They're like, look, we hope it finds its way out into the wild.
This is the exterminator's solution. It's just come in and we're going to throw up a wall right there. And,
it makes sense.
And we're going to say that you can't get through it unless you can speak to snakes.
That castle's already a fucking death trap, so why not? And we'll put it in the girls' bathroom. Yeah, the girls' bathroom.
Yeah,
as a quick side note for the entire Harry Potter series, they have these moments where they're like, there is this terrifying creature called the Basilisk that's living down below. And then everyone's like, oh yeah, and there's also a shit ton of giant spiders in the forest and a tree that beats the shit out of you. And they're like, but the Basilisk, it's some bad shit, man. And it's like, you're living in a house of horrors and you picked like the one creature.
And half of them are like teaching you physics. And
magic physics.
Oh, well.
Professor Snape, what happened?
Used too much wolfsbane extract, looks like.
He used one extra drop. That margin for error is pretty bloody slim.
The spell was supposed to change our eye color. Why would we risk exploding skulls just to change our eye color?
So, we like to do a versus every week, and normally we build up to a kind of big round robin at the end of, but look, this series has already gone off the rails in terms of that. So Dave has come up with a fantastic scenario for us this week of, you know, who would win. Dave, you want to give us the scenario?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've talked about whether or not the basilisk was actually domesticated or not, or whether or not it's just some giant creature running around in the basement of Hogwarts. And I think that if Hogwarts did decide that it wanted to try and tame the basilisk and it wanted to bring someone in, it would probably look to bring in an expert, maybe someone who claims that he's without fear, someone who claims that he has the ability to tame these types of wild animals. And I can think of no better candidate than Joe Exotic, considering we've already mentioned him a few times in this episode.
Famous 2016 independent presidential candidate, Joe Exotic.
My scenario is Dumbledore decides, you know what, we're going to get in an expert to tame the basilisk that's living in the basement. Joe Exotic, they travel in the same circles, and Joe Exotic happens to reach out to him at a party and is like, you know what, Dumbledore, I think I can help you out here. And so we find ourselves standing at the top of the stairs as Joe Exotic descends towards the lair of the basilisk. And I ask you, who would win?
How glorious is Joe Exotic's mullet?
It's in full prime.
It's bleach blonde. It is beautiful. It's the brightest thing you've ever seen in your life. He doesn't need a flashlight.
Flowing over his shoulders.
Is there any way that Joe Exotic's mullet could trigger a response whereby the basilisk thinks it's a phoenix tail?
No, but I will allow Joe Exotic to bring one tiger with him.
Oh, okay. To feed to the basilisk?
Or the tiger looks at the basilisk, looks at Joe Exotic, and there's this unspoken bond between the basilisk and the tiger, and they both turn on Joe Exotic.
That could also happen.
So, straight up, Joe Exotic comes down into the basement, plus or minus one tiger, and has to face off against the basilisk. Who wins?
Oh, man.
Joe Exotic gets murked instantly.
Oh, instantly.
Yeah, I don't think Joe Exotic has much experience with magic. And I think, not the fact he's facing a 25-meter snake, but I think the lack of experience with magic is what's going to let him down.
The best part of this is the level of overconfidence I feel that Joe Exotic would bring to this. As he approaches it with like one hand out, he like gets himself into like a posture to try and tame it. And he's narrating the entire time.
Tiger claws.
Right, as the basilisk just rears up and eats him, and the tiger that he's brought along just flees up the stairs into Hogwarts where it starts feeding on children as
yep.
Dumbledore looks on and all of this and just goes like, fuck.
Not again.
Yeah. Good times. I want some fan fiction. People, if you're listening, that's your bestseller right there. Amazon.com. Put it out on the Kindle for $12. I'll buy it. We'll plug it on the podcast. We'll plug it on Ecology for the Masses.
First thing is, I am not cutting my hair. I'm not changing the way I dress. I refuse to wear a suit. I am broke as shit. I have a judgment against me from some bitch down there in Florida. I'm Joe Exotic. And don't forget.
All right. I think that's it for this week. Like, subscribe, tell your friends about us, all that sort of that good shit. Drop us a note if you enjoy the podcast. And Adam, you want to sign us off?
Stay socially distant, please.
Yes, physically distant, not socially distant. We all need each other in times like this.
We are a social species. And as social species, we should remember that the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
That'll help you through the coronavirus. That monster is very real.
Jesus.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
One year ago, he learned the truth.
You're a wizard, Harry.
And his first year at Hogwarts School became legend. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
Let us hope. Mr. Potter will always be around to save the day.
Don't worry, I will wait.